The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. Coming up on the show, paleontologists in Johannesburg have discovered a new species of human relative in a cave in South Africa. Homo naledi is the single largest fossil hominin to be found on the African continent. We speak to the leader of the expeditions that discovered the fossils and ask how significant Homo naledi might be in shedding light on our origins and on the diversity of the human genus. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Scientists from Wits University in Johannesburg have discovered a new species of human relative, Homo naledi, in a cave in South Africa's Cradle of Humankind World Heritage Site, northwest of Johannesburg. The discovery consists of more than 1,500 numbered fossil elements from at least 15 individuals of the same species, laying in a chamber 90 metres from the cave entrance, accessible only by a very narrow chute. It becomes the best-known fossil member of our lineage, a hugely significant find. Professor Lee Berger led the Wits University expeditions which discovered and recovered the fossils. John Hawkes of the University of Wisconsin-Madison is a senior author on the paper describing the new species. I asked them what it is that they found.
We found a new species of primitive hominin that we are placing within the genus Homo. We're calling it Homo naledi. That is really quite remarkable. It's a mosaic of features from a very tiny brain to tiny teeth, but that are relatively primitive in their overall morphology, to a unusual ape-like thorax all the way down to the pelvis, with arms and legs that are more reminiscent of a human, and fingers that are as curved as anything we've seen in the fossil record, except for hominids that maybe date back to over 5 million years, like Arty. More remarkably, we found the largest assemblage of hominins ever discovered in the history of the search for human origins in Africa. Over 1,550 remains so far, having left thousands of remains in the chamber, of more than 15 individuals from infants to very old adults.
So this is an extinct early human. And what exactly would it look like in terms of if it were stood in front of me?
Well, firstly, I would say that they're not human. If naledi was standing in front of you, you would think anything but human. You would see a relatively tall, males would be about 5 foot tall, females a little bit shorter than that, pinheaded, non-human. They would be superficially human if you include just bipedalism as that definition. But this tiny head would be perched atop this 5 foot skinny body, with proportions that would be broadly similar to ours, but with a chest and thorax that would probably give it a gangly, long-legged appearance, human to you at all.
Tell us about the site where you found these. It sounds as if it's an extraordinary place.
Well, the site is extraordinary. The Dinaledi Chamber, which means Chamber of Stars, which is tribute, by the way, to the rising star system that the fossils were discovered in, is a remote, deep underground chamber. At its deepest, around 40 meters below the surface. It's a relatively small area, but within it are these remains, literally in clay and dirt on the floor and buried within the floor, of perhaps dozens of individuals, thousands of fragmentary and articulated remains. The chamber is practically inaccessible. Our explorers have to go down through a 7.5-inch wide chute, dropping down almost 50 feet below the surface to get into this chamber. It is a remarkably difficult place, and it has always been a difficult place to get into because only Homo naledi could get in there. No other animal before, during, or after was able to get into this deep chamber.
What was it about your team that made you want to explore it? It sounds as if it's very difficult to even know the chamber's there unless you're exploring this cave anyway. I mean, it's a remarkable find. I'm wondering how you even ended up finding the chamber.
After 2008, when I had created this map of potential cave sites and fossil sites. It actually led to the discovery of Malapa and Australopithecus sediba. I effectively quit exploring. As we were building a lab in 2013 over the site of Malapa, it became clear to me that I hadn't been back out in the field. I was actually prevented from going to Malapa because this lab was being built over the top of it. And that led me to want to get back out there. But I didn't want to just repeat the exercise I'd done in 2008. So at that point, a former student of mine, Pedro Boshoff, who I'd caved with all through the 90s, looking for sites underground in this region. And this region is littered, by the way, with hundreds of kilometers of underground cave systems, came into my office looking for work. And I enlisted him to start underground exploration. I employed him. He found two amateurs, Rick Hunter and Steve Tucker, who were, how can I say this delicately, physiologically appropriate for going into deep caves. That is, they were tiny and skinny. And we began exploring caves in the immediate vicinity of many of the places we knew best, including the Sterkfontein Valley. The Rising Star System was a system that was known for more than 50 years, one of the most explored caves in southern Africa. Rick and Steve, one day in mid-September, went off the map, found this slot, descended down this remarkable chute, and entered the chamber that would eventually yield this remarkable discovery.
But the fact that you have to go through this slot, and it doesn't look easy from what I've seen, to me would make me think, oh, the chances of there being some ancient hominid remains on the other side of that would surely be minimal, because how would they get there?
Well, the last part of your question, how did they get there, is the question that I think may vex humanity and be a question asked around the world for a very long time. But the fact that the very nature of exploration is going places that you don't think you know what you're going to find. And that's really one of the huge lessons of this exercise. The reason that this site is 800 meters from the site of Swartkrans, one of the best-known caves in Africa, a kilometer and a half from Sterkfontein. It's exactly that people didn't bother to go into these confined environments that this was never discovered for 90 years. Yet, and maybe that's why Naledi was going into them, because they were difficult to get to.
But do you think these remains got there through some kind of early version of a burial process, or is that overinterpreting what's going on here?
We, as a team, eliminated all the probable. This is not a mass death. The remains came in over time. This is not a catastrophic event. There's no evidence of that. This was not some water flow moving bodies from one place to another. The sediments exclude that. There's no predator damage. There's no scavenger damage, and all the sediments themselves originated from inside the chamber. We have, after eliminating all of the probable, come effectively to the conclusion that the improbable must be true, and that Homo naledi was utilizing this cave, this chamber, in a ritualized fashion, that is, in a repeated fashion, to deliberately dispose of its dead there. If you want to interpret that as a form of burial, it is, but that tends to be a human term. But until this moment, of course, no other animal has ever been demonstrated to do this behavior except us. In fact, it perhaps defined us.
I wonder if one of you could give us a sense of what it would take to deposit the bodies in there. I mean, this is up, you go inside the cave, but then you need to go up a fair bit to go through this fissure. What, can one of you take me through that?
This is John. Our present pathway through the cave takes us more than 200 meters twisting and turning to where we can get to this chamber, and it's very difficult to access. Now, we don't know that the passage to the Dinaledi chamber was as tortuous in the past as it is today. Caves do change over time. What we can show is that the Dinaledi chamber itself was never exposed to the outside environment, that the nearby chambers, including the Dragon's Back chamber, which is where we get to this chamber from, were not exposed to the outside environment, and that the entrance to the Dinaledi chamber was in the dark. So minimally, Homo naledi must have been entering into the dark zone of a cave, presumably with dead bodies, and at least depositing them at the top of this chute that goes down into the Dinaledi chamber. Now, beyond that, we don't know if they were accessing the chamber going into it. We don't know how far it was from the entrance, how difficult. And, of course, we're going to do the best that we can to find those details out. But at a minimum, this was a very challenging thing in the past to do, something that excluded other species of medium, large-sized mammals from accessing the chamber.
I've been hearing about this group of people you had on the team called being referred to as underground astronauts. Can you tell us about those?
That's my fault. In the throes of enthusiasm, we'd set up a command center. We laid 3.5 kilometers of underground fiber optic cable, audio cable, so that people who are more physiologically inappropriate to get into this chamber, like John and myself and the other senior scientists, could be there, both to instruct the excavation, to answer questions, and I guess to voyeuristically observe a place that we shall never be. The explorers that I found, the 6 young women that are hugely qualified, all with degrees in paleoanthropology or archaeology, who did this, undertook extraordinary dangerous work, and they could fit into this chamber. It was a torturous and dangerous activity. The word underground astronaut came around, which, of course, it's entirely inappropriate. They should be referred to as people who work underground, not in space. But there was a sense of separation from us. We sat in this command center watching often infrared black and white pictures as these explorers would move into this system away from us 45 minutes entering the chamber. And it really did have the feel of a spacewalk, I think it's fair to say.
In more ways than you imagine. You know, they trained intensively to know what they were doing underground when they were in the chamber. They had to suit up and prep for it. You know, it was in a lot of ways like going on a spacewalk.
And what were they doing for the actual project? Were they actually gathering remains?
Oh, absolutely. We had a complete protocol, obviously modified with technology to work in this extreme environment. We used white light scanners to do high-resolution images of the floor and the fossils as they came out, because you couldn't put up a theodolite in a grid. We had laser surveyed the interior area of the cave. We used protocols that are fairly close to standard archaeological protocols to painstakingly remove these fossils, first from the floor and then from the very tiny excavation, which resulted in this huge number of fossils being removed. But these were extreme conditions. They were working on their knees where they couldn't stand up, two at a time, clustered around an excavation area because no one else could fit. And these are not exactly large people anyway. And then material would be transported as recovered after being mapped up through a chain of rescue cavers and safety cavers up the chute, out through the cave, and eventually would emerge into the daylight at the command center and then cataloged into the science tent.
What did your colleagues think when they first looked down into this chamber? And presumably, a lot of this material was visible.
Well, the first explorers, initially, Rick and Steve were amateurs. They are, by the way, no longer. They're now professional explorers. They've been working for me continuously for 2 years. We actually have a large exploration team in the field full-time now. When they first entered the chamber, they tell me that they knew it was bones. They didn't realize that it was important. They went back with photographs after seeing some of the casts that we'd given them, and they realized that it did look similar to some of the things that we were interested in. The photographs came to me at 9 p.m. on October 1st, and it was at that moment that I realized that this was truly an extraordinary find, because there in the images that I was seeing was what looked like a primitive hominid just lying on the floor of a chamber. I thought it was one skeleton at that time. I, of course, would later be proved to be wrong. In fact, on the second day, November 11th, that we were active underground, we'd realized that there were multiple individuals, and this was not just going to be a normal recovery. Well, there's no such thing as a normal recovery of an early hominid, but it was not going to be just the recovery of a hominid skeleton.
Why do you think remains of this new species have not been found previously elsewhere, that they are all confined to this incredibly inaccessible chamber?
You know, that is such a great question. And of course, looking as we are at the evidence that there is an intentional deposition of bodies, you know, the one possibility is that we just haven't found the right places. We don't know the age of these fossils. We don't know how long ago in geological terms they existed. So another possibility is that we haven't been looking in the right time period for these fossils. But I think that more than anything else, this is a testament to the fact that here's an area that we thought was the most intensively explored for early hominin remains anywhere on Earth. And in a remote corner of a cave, we find something that's completely different, completely unexpected, and in an abundance that we've never discovered.
In simplistic terms, maybe they've been hiding themselves from us.
Yeah.
I mean, think about it like this. If you drop down onto a modern city like Johannesburg that we're sitting in right now, in a million years, you're an archaeologist, what is your likelihood of finding a human, even though millions and millions of people live here? Well, you would find cattle, sheep, goats, pigs, fish, birds in the form of chickens, all the things we eat, dogs and cats, tons of that. But unless you dropped onto one of the tiny, minute cemeteries that exist here, or by chance onto a morgue, you'd not see a human. Perhaps that's been a lesson of paleoanthropology, and perhaps Naledi is one of the first times we've bumped into something like that. That's just speculation. It could also be that we've never sampled this time period before. It could be that tiny bits of Naledi have been found, but people have just wrongly attributed them to another species or another form because they couldn't imagine there's another thing walking around out there.
Why has it been so difficult to find the age of these remains, to date them with any kind of accuracy or any give them any date at all?
Well, it's pretty simple. It's the first time in all of history we've found a fossil hominid sitting in a chamber alone. There's nothing there with them. There are no fauna that we can get an idea of how old they are. The sediments that are in the chamber derive from only within the chamber itself. That is, except for those related to the bones of the hominids themselves. There's no overlying rock that sits on top of them that cemented them in. There's no underlying rock we can date easily that tells us a minimum age, and we were not until they're published, in fact it'd probably be illegal, for us to destroy some of these fossil hominids in order to try to do the most improbable dating of young dates like radiocarbon or ESR. Now that they are published, we will be moving in that direction. And, you know, one of the neat things about science is this. We'd never had this problem before. Scientists, once given a problem, humans, once given a problem, are great at solving problems. I'll bet you we're able to date this eventually. But you can bet that we're not going to put some flimsy date out. Because no matter how old Homo naledi, it is going to have profound impact on our understanding of human origins, whether it's very young, whether it's intermediate, whether it looks like what it should be, 2-3 million years old, or whether it's older than that. Wherever it is, because of its behavior, because of its morphology, it will have profound impact. And we're not going to produce a flippant date. We will make sure that we have that date well before we release it.
I'd love finally to go through some of the possibilities that this species raises, depending on how old it is. I mean, it's already an extraordinary mix of features that range from Homo sapiens back to species that were around pre-homogeneous, correct?
That's right. That's right, in almost every aspect. So, you know, if you just play through the scenarios, I'll do the younger ones and John can take the older ones. Let's say that the impossible, that this species is sort of like a coelacanth. It's an ancient species that's come down through time and is only tens of thousands of years old or hundreds of thousands of years old. That means that at those times that we had a complex species, equal in complexity to us in at least certain critical aspects of its behavior, that was a long-distance walker, capable of climbing, that had complex social grouping, that perhaps thought about its own mortality, wandering around Africa, perhaps with its tool-making hands making complex tools. It's going to make archaeology very difficult because we won't know who made who, what, on that African fan. And that's going to deal complexities. It also means that we have to look at what were the driving forces behind the evolution of different species at different times and always be cognizant that there might be these cryptic species out there parallel to that having an influence on the record we see. So anything under 2 million years old will have, I think, relatively dramatic effect on our understanding of archaeology in the Pleistocene and how we interpret the sort of modes and tempos of human and pre-human ancestor behavior. And then, of course, that leads you to what if it's very early?
Yeah, if we look at what its anatomy looks like, in its skull, its form is very reminiscent of early members of our genus, species like Homo habilis, Homo rudolfensis, and the earliest part of Homo erectus. Now, as we've described, other parts of its skeleton are giving us different pictures. Its feet are more human-like than those species. Its trunk is more primitive than those species. And so, although it probably roots in our family tree at the origin of Homo, it's telling us that that evolutionary history at the origin of our genus was probably different than we had imagined based on the more fragmentary remains that we have from other parts of Africa. So that's an important key, is that we think we know more or less where it connects to our family tree, but it tells us that what happened then wasn't what we thought. Now, it could be surprisingly earlier than we might have expected for that kind of anatomy. You know, this could be stretching back into millions of years, in which case it's telling us about the early origins of our genus and how we transformed into the human-like creatures that we would later be. We don't know if Naledi is an ancestor. We know that it connects to us in the realm of those early Homo species, but we don't know exactly where. And figuring out exactly where is going to be a big challenge for us. And we don't know if it could be substantially later and have its own long history from that ancestry that's shared in common with us.
Well, and of course, if that type of behavior, that sort of complex, near symbolic or ritualistic behavior, recognition of self-mortality, is very ancient, then that too has implications for our understanding of sort of mode and tempo of the entirety of hominin evolution.
What do you want to look at now? This raises all sorts of questions. You must have your research projects lined up for the next decade after this.
Oh, we do. And, you know, what do we want to look at now? Everything. And in fact, you know, this enormous team is doing that. You're going to see, quite literally, a flood of papers that have been prepared that will be coming out over the next months and months that have already been prepared on things like the morphology. But this opens up a richness of questions that we've often never been able to ask in paleoanthropology. Things like growth and development, things like the details of behavior, maybe even things in the society of the species that are going on that we never dreamed we could ask about an early hominid species. But now that we have this incredible population that we'll be able to, and probably things we can't imagine right now as we move into the age of things like DNA testing and other experiments.
Lee Berger and John Hawkes. I also spoke to Professor Chris Stringer, head of human origins at the Natural History Museum in London, who was not involved in this particular study. I started by asking him what people should make of the discovery.
Well, I think the key thing is that, you know, there's so much of the material, over 1,500 fossils, so it really will tell us a lot about what seems to be an early stage in human evolution. So this is a creature which does combine human-like and non-human features in a way we haven't seen before. And the amount of material and the fact, of course, the promise that what they've got so far is only part of what is in this site. So we could end up with many thousands of bones, perhaps even 15 complete skeletons of a primitive human species.
So what is your take on what this species actually represents? I mean, you've said how it's a mixture of human and sort of other features. I mean, let's be just a bit, sort of flesh that out a bit more. I mean, you're talking about it being a mix of modern human, like Homo sapien features, and pre-Homo features, or what exactly?
Well, yes, it's got all of those. So the hands and feet, for example, functionally look like they worked much as our feet and hands do, and that of the Neanderthals. So the morphology of the hands and feet is very like, you know, humans that lived within the last 100,000 years. And yet, on the other hand, the brain size is ape size. You know, the brain is about the same size as a gorilla's brain. You have elements of the teeth, for example, are quite small and rather simple. And yet, when you look at the shoulders or the arms or the hip joint, again, it looks much more like creatures which were alive more than 2 million years ago.
So does that, for you, place these remains in some particular period of time? Because one of the rather frustrating things about this study is they've not dated them.
Well, that's right. Yes, the material remains to be dated, and I'm sure the team are working on that, but that is one of the frustrating elements. And I mean, normally, let's say more than 10 years ago, if we looked at this morphology, we'd say, well, this has to be a primitive human. It could be 2 million years old. But of course, in the last 10 years, we've learnt about a rather primitive looking creature over in the island of Flores, that nicknamed the Hobbit, Homo floresiensis. Now, that creature was around within the last 100,000 years, living in isolation, and it retained what seemed to be some very primitive features, including a brain even smaller than the one of Homo naledi. So I think we have to be careful. We can't assume the age of a specimen just by looking at its morphology anymore, and it will be really a good thing if the team can pin down the date. But obviously, I believe that, Lee Berger considers the material could be even as old as 3 million years, which would be incredible and would place it right close to the very origins of our own genus, the genus Homo.
If that is the case, and it's a huge if, that would suggest it is what? It is a form that emerged from what other species?
Well, the creatures around at that time, 3 million years ago, were, of course, these Australopithecines, the southern apes. There was also a creature living in East Africa called Kenyanthropus. So these creatures walked upright, but in many aspects, such as brain size and so on, they were still rather ape-like. They may have been starting to use tools and so on. So they were a kind of halfway house, if you like, in terms of human evolution. Now, this creature, Homo naledi, does show some more advanced features, and yet it retains that small brain, it retains some primitive features in the hips. It's got curved finger bones, for example, which might imply there's still some moving around in the trees. So it's another mix of features that we haven't seen before in the fossil record. And if we placed it, if it does lie back beyond, let's say, 2.5 million years, it really does take us close to the origins of our own genus. And of course, so much of the attention has been focused on East Africa for the discoveries of the very first humans. This would, of course, switch the focus down to South Africa. But as I'm sort of fond of pointing out, of course, those two regions are only two regions within a huge continent, which is still largely unexplored for its human fossils. So if we're finding this kind of material down in South Africa, who knows what was, for example, in Central Africa or West Africa 2 or 3 million years ago. So we must always remember that our evidence is still really rather localized within Africa.
It seems strange to a layman that you can go for all the decades and longer that scientists have been looking out in the field for ancient human remains and so on, that you can go so long without finding any evidence of this new species and all of a sudden find 15 at once. It seems odd. Is it not strange?
Well, it's possibly strange, because if this creature was living in a relatively isolated region, then it only lived there, and so one has to look in that region. But the possibility is that it was more widespread, and in which case, when we come to look at other fossil remains, we might find that they, in fact, represent this new species. So there are small-bodied creatures. They've been called a small form of Homo erectus, another primitive human species, in East Africa. Now, when we look at those again, maybe they'll show resemblances to this new species, and maybe they would represent the new species rather than a small form of Homo erectus. That remains to be seen.
And do you think this really is a new species? You don't think it could be a species that's already known but just came to look this way after living in isolation for so long?
Well, its combination of features is unique. And as is pointed out in the publications, there are some really quirky features, for example, in the thumb bones, which are found in all the individuals that have this thumb bone represented and which are not found in any other known human or human-like species. So there are some quirky features there. Yes, it might be a result of isolation, as was the story of the Hobbit in Flores, but equally it might be a sign that this is indeed the kind of creature that gave rise to later humans.
What of all of this is the most surprising to you as someone very steeped in this kind of research?
I think the surprise is the mixture of features it shows. You know, if we look at the hands and feet, we would say this is an advanced human. If we look at the brain or the pelvis or the upper body, we'd say it's something much more primitive. So it's that combination of features which reminds us that the origins of our genus Homo are likely to have been quite complex, and we still have a lot to learn about them.
Does it suggest very finally that these modern attributes that we might, you know, very much like to or be used to associating just with Homo sapiens were actually something that were far more primitive, have far more history than we expect?
Well, indeed, that could be true. I think that's one of the interesting questions, that because this material is so complete, it has virtually every part of the skeleton represented, we lack most of those bones for some of these early human species. Therefore, this may be telling us that when we have more complete material, we will find that some of those other early human species did have more human-like characteristics in their whole skeleton than we would have thought. So I think that's a question, obviously, for the future with more discoveries.
Just one more on how these fossils came to be, how these remains got to be where they are. It's quite a chamber that they were found in. It's quite a tricky way to get there. And I think Lee Berger's interpretation is that they were put there intentionally as almost some sort of burial. And I wonder what you made of that.
Well, yes, that is one of the puzzles. Obviously, the age of the material is a big puzzle. How it got where it is a big puzzle. If we're talking about intentional disposal of these bodies, then we're talking about creatures with a brain the size of a gorilla going deep into a cave, into the dark, and then kind of posting bodies through really quite small fissures into this cave chamber. So it is remarkably complex behaviour for what we would think of as a very primitive human-like species. Whether there are other possible explanations, I think, remains to be seen. But I think, you know, that is certainly one of the most plausible explanations, because it is an extraordinary accumulation. Virtually the only material in this chamber is the 15 partial skeletons of Homo naledi.
Other animals aren't there, so it doesn't look as if lots of stuff washed in there.
Well, that's right, yes. There are some very fragmentary bones of birds and small mammals, but no large mammals, no evidence this was a carnivore den, no evidence humans were ever living there, no evidence, it seems, that the material could have washed in there from somewhere else, because it is so complete and articulated. You can fit the pieces together as they were in life. So it does suggest that the material basically decomposed where it is being excavated.
Presumably this is going to give you and a lot of other people in your field something to think about for the next sort of few years, probably.
Well, absolutely. Plus the fact, of course, as I mentioned, that there are probably thousands more fossils to come from further excavation in this chamber. So, yes, exciting times.
Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you've got many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
Nicola Davis, commissioning editor of Observer Tech Monthly, joins me now. What have you got in this month's edition, Nicola?
Well, this month we have a Future of Food special, so it's 8 pages looking at everything from what we're going to be eating in the future to how we're going to eat it, how we're going to cook it, how we're going to grow it, and how we're going to share it. So it's a pretty comprehensive look into the years to come.
What are we going to be eating in the future? What's wrong with burgers and curries?
There's going to be a whole lot of new ingredients on the menu. Obviously, insects are going to become quite a big thing, good source of protein and quite a low carbon footprint. So they're a winner. And we also have a lovely recipe for a jellyfish dish as well. As you might have heard, the seas around the UK are becoming quite rife with jellyfish. So perhaps this is something we could do with them.
I'm not convinced that is my future for food. You mentioned sharing it.
Yes, absolutely. There's a lot of websites and apps now which allow you to share food in innovative ways. So one of our writers has tested out a new sort of on-demand food delivery service which aims to bring you sort of Michelin-starred meals to your door. So she tests that out to see if it's really any better than a standard takeaway. It certainly costs a lot more. So whether the the proof of the experience was in the eating, we will find out. And there's also new websites for sharing, for example, your leftover foods, new kind of supper club ideas, all sorts of things.
You
can share your leftover food, yeah.
Go on.
I think it's called Leftover Swap. Then there's also exciting foray into the future when it comes to how we cook. So I went down and saw a fantastic robotic kitchen, which had this enormous pair of arms that is capable of preparing a very tasty, I must say, crab bisque for you, which was quite fantastic. It was very graceful, very elegant in its movements.
When you say these arms, they were enormous. How enormous?
They were larger than life-size arms and with many jointed hands on the end. So they sort of look like human arms, only much bigger. And these hands, they're, considering that they're a machine, they're extremely sort of nimble and delicate. And what they did was they sort of used motion capture technology and these sensor-clad gloves. And they had MasterChef winner, I think from 2011, Tim Anderson, go through the motions of making this dish. And then what they did was they monitored all his movements and they basically replicated them with the robot. So the robot moves just like a human would move. It's quite uncanny. When its arms are sort of resting, waiting for the next step, you can sort of see them move slightly like a human's arms would sort of just go up and down a little bit as it's waiting.
Presumably you have to stand next to it and give it the bits and bobs it needs to make the meal.
No, what happens is, at the moment, I mean, it's currently in its prototyping stage, but at this point, you basically have to prepare the ingredients and put them on a certain section of the work surface in the right place. But then you can just step back and it takes about, I think it's about 20, 25 minutes or something. And it will carefully make this soup. And what's fantastic is it sort of like taps the spoon on the side of the pot, just like your eye would. So it's quite mesmerising, I have to say.
So a massive knife-wielding robot with bigger than human arms.
Currently it can't wield a knife, but in the future
it probably must need a knife to cook, surely.
Well, in the future they're going to. At the moment you have to pre-chop things.
Can it use a spatula?
It can use a spatula.
That
can
be lethal.
It can also use a blender,
hands,
which was quite fabulous. It was very, very nifty with that blender.
Let's move on to Richard Dawkins.
Well, yes, so we have a fantastic interview by Carol Cadwallader with Richard Dawkins. So he's got his next section of his memoirs out called Brief Candle in the Dark. So Carol met up with him in Oxford and quizzed him on everything from his concept of memes right the way through to his Twitter spats. And it's a really, really fun and fascinating.
Does he still think his sort of aggressive brand of atheism is working in terms of, you know, convincing people that he's right, that there is no God and all the rest of it?
Well, it's funny because I think he doesn't necessarily see himself as coming across as aggressive or in person, at least Carol says, you know, it's not got that kind of persona that perhaps comes across on Twitter. So it's quite.
But his brand of atheism is very different to, say, Martin Rees's, where, you know, Lord Rees would be a very, you know, gentle and thoughtful man. And I know, you know, Richard Dawkins isn't, you know, a lot that he's portrayed to be, but his type of approach has certainly got an edge to it that you don't see with others.
He says he doesn't like a ruckus. So you'll have to read the rest of the interview to get a bit more of an insight, I think, into his mind.
And finally, you've got a piece on driverless cars as well.
Yes, we've sent Tim Adams out to have a go in the Google car and also in BMW's high-tech vehicle. And so he's been looking at the two rather different mindsets of those companies. So you have the car companies who are essentially creating, sort of starting with a car and sort of building in all this fantastic technology. And you have technology companies who are starting, obviously, from the other end of the spectrum and starting with the computer and sort of building a car for the first time. So it's a very interesting piece because it looks at two very different visions for the future and for what driverless cars are about and how they should be brought in service. So the Google approach is, you know, we're going to change the world, this is going to be revolutionary, we're going to go to these driverless cars and it's going to be like a huge change. Whereas the car companies seem to be saying, oh, no, you don't want to do it dramatically. You want to take a softly approach and gradually introduce people to this technology. So Tim has a look at the merits of both sides of that and quizzes the companies about their views on that.
So that's Tech Monthly in The Observer this Sunday. And that's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to Lee Berger, John Hawkes, Chris Stringer and Nicola Davis. From me, Ian Sample, and all the science team, thanks for listening.